It is Friday, December the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, seeking an end to Libya's political crisis.
Even if you have the two quasi-government entities together, you still have hundreds of thousands of Libyans under arms that are part of militia. Some are allied with one half of this government, some are allied with the other half, but quite a few are not allied with either.
Also ahead, Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency plus celebrating Christmas in song. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution backing last week's signing of a UN-brokered national unity agreement in Libya and urged members of the country's rival administrations to implement the Morocco deal within 30 days. Britain's UN ambassador, Matthew Rycroft, presented the draft resolution, then spoke to reporters after the council vote.
The international community has today declared our united support for the Libyan political agreement that was signed last week in Skhirat in Morocco, and we've spoken with one voice in support of a government of national accord of Libya based in Tripoli and which the signatories of the agreement pledged to create. It's a positive step for Libya. The UK commends the parties to the agreement for working together in a spirit of compromise and reconciliation to seek the consensus that is so needed in the interests of all of the people of Libya. The resolution is a strong collective sign of the international community's commitment to Libya's sovereignty, independence, territorial integrity, national unity, all under a single government of national accord. And we urge all those who have not yet signed to do so now, to support the agreement, and to work with the government of national accord once formed. The door is open to them.
Rycroft said the international community stands ready to work with the new government of national accord to help deliver what he called a stable, prosperous future for all Libyans and that they deserve it. Libya's UN ambassador told the Associated Press for now his country will hold off asking the international community to intervene with airstrikes against the growing presence of the Islamic State group. University of San Francisco Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype that while the Security Council's action is welcome, it is no guarantee to bring peace and stability to a country that has known neither in the past 4 years.
The problem, of course, is that even if you have the two quasi-government entities together, you still have hundreds of thousands of Libyans under arms that are part of militia. Some are allied with one half of this government, some are allied with the other half, but quite a few are not allied with either.
The council is urging Libya to form a unity government within 30 days. Is that going to be possible?
It's quite possible that they could work out some kind of government coalition. However, will they be an actually unified government, or will they essentially govern the areas of Libya they currently control jointly, with only a facade of some kind of broader governing structure? The other question, I think, is whether Libyan people themselves are happy with the arrangement. Remember, the Libyans, in their free election right after the fall of Gaddafi, but before things fell apart in these armed conflicts, voted for a moderate government, but seemed to be very much interested in democracy. And it was a grassroots, initially nonviolent struggle that started the uprising, that later turned violent and ended up ousting Gaddafi. So there is civil society to contend with. And while civil society has been traditionally weak in that country, the real question is whether the government will listen to the Libyan people and not just the men with guns.
The speakers of both rival governments have rejected this deal. Is there a possibility that this will be scotched even before it gets underway?
That is quite possible. It could also mean that they're just posturing, trying to hold out for getting a bigger piece of the pie as they divide things up. And this may be the biggest problem. In the past few years, when it's been ruled by various armed factions, people have lost the art of compromise. You know, whether the lack of unity the country's had in recent years and most of the country's rule since independence, either being under an authoritarian monarch or under Gaddafi, there's not much experience in the kind of give and take that's necessary to compromise with one's rivals.
Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. He was speaking via Skype with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead, making some headway against the Taliban.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Officials in Afghanistan say national forces backed by U.S. airstrikes have regained control of a key district in the southern province of Helmand, that from the Taliban militants. U.S. military spokesman Colonel Michael Lawhorn confirmed to VOA that American aircraft participated in the fighting in the Sangin district. Colonel Lawhorn speaks now with International Edition's Ira Melman about the latest development in Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency.
What is happening, the most importantly, is that the Afghans are the ones doing the fighting. I know there's been a lot of attention on it this week. Helmand province as a whole remains a very contested area. We've said that. We knew that this was going to be difficult throughout this year. Helmand is the main effort for the Afghan security forces. But our mission has not changed. We continue to train, advise, and assist our Afghan partners. And the Afghans are the ones that are doing the fighting in and around Sangin.
Why is Helmand so important to NATO and the combined forces and also to the Taliban?
Well, it's the traditional homeland of the Taliban. The Taliban have also made that their main effort. They have a large presence down there. And they have said for years their plan is to try to take over Helmand, and Sangin is one of the smaller provinces, but it's important to their overall effort because of where it's located. Sangin is just north of a major highway that cuts east-west across the Helmand province, and it sits on a major north-south highway. So it's both tactically important from the area that it controls, that large intersection of the two main highways that intersect in Helmand province, and also spiritually and emotionally significant to the Taliban.
What about financially as far as the poppy crop is concerned?
Well, that's obviously one of the main sources of income for the various Taliban groups. And interestingly enough, that's one of the areas in which we see a lot of the conflict between the various Taliban groups in Afghanistan and the Daesh, what we could refer to as Daesh, or the ISIS groups that are trying to make headway. They're fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan right now, and a lot of that conflict has to do with control of poppies, control of the opium, control of organized crime in and around Afghanistan as a source of fundraising for the various insurgent groups. One of the things that's important to remember, a lot of these guys who are in these groups, probably 70 to 90% of them, have been in one or more previous groups over the course of the last years. A lot of times you'll see these guys change their T-shirts, if you will. They get disaffected, disenfranchised with a certain group. They feel they might have more success joining a different group, and they move back and forth. So that's one of the things that makes it kind of hard to estimate the numbers of any particular group at any given time. But what we're seeing is a lot of conflict between Daesh, between the various Taliban groups here, and the Afghan National Army is busy fighting both of them as well.
And how are they doing?
We've seen a lot of improvement. Is it where we'd like it to be right now? It's probably not where we want it to be in the future. There's still a lot of areas for improvement, and we have some things in the works to help improve that. Early next year, you'll see the Afghans get their first delivery of fixed-wing aircraft. They're pilots that have been just graduated from training back in the United States. Afghan pilots are going to come here. They're going to start employing fixed-wing aircraft to do close air support with Afghan forces. They've done a really good job of improving the way they integrate their own helicopter. We have a new helicopter called the MD-530. It's a light helicopter armed with machine guns and some rockets, and they're able to do close air support on their own. And most importantly, they have kept the Taliban from making any strategic gains anywhere in Afghanistan in 2015.
That is U.S. military spokesman Colonel Michael Lorne. He was speaking with my colleague Ira Melman. And my other colleague, same show, Jim Stevenson, joins us now with some social media response to what's happening in Afghanistan.
A lot of posts out there talking about what was happening in Sangin. One that reads, Afghanistan, dozens of Taliban killed in battle for Sangin, a local Taliban commander, and 50 fighters killed. Fox News tweets, is the Taliban regaining the upper hand in Afghanistan? A thoughtful piece about what is happening there at the moment. Afghan troops rushed to area under Taliban attack. That, a news item from Kabul, also being widely tweeted. Afghanistan's fight for Sangin, a key psychological battle for both sides. There were a series of unconfirmed tweets that have been circulating around, unidentified helicopters dropping off Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan. That, of course, another name for Islamic State fighters. And as Colonel Lawhorn had alluded to in that report we just heard with Ira Melman, some interesting interaction on Twitter between nations. The official Twitter account of Turkey's presidency, at TR Presidency, tweets, we endeavor to further strengthen our unshakable ties with Afghanistan. And then Xinhua News, at XH News, tweets, Turkey is the real face of USA policy, terroristic. The occupation of Afghanistan is also against China, in addition to oil routes. Also trending on the topic, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is arriving in Kabul to inaugurate the Afghan parliament that was built by India, that happening later in the day. And also new details on the recent attack in Afghanistan that killed six U.S. Air Force personnel.
And many thanks to you, Jim. International Edition's Jim Stevenson, filling in for our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, who has been on leave this week. You know, you can follow Jim on Twitter. His handle is at VOA Stevenson. And G's on Twitter as well. She is at G. Abby Lee. I'm there also at VOA Norman. And International Edition is on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many of the migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe this year are children, and many of those who drown from those frail or overcrowded boats capsizing on the Aegean or the Mediterranean are also children. The humanitarian organization Save the Children says despite the generosity of many countries and individuals, too little is being done to protect the migrant and refugee children. Kirsty McNeil is with Save the Children and speaks now from London. She tells VOA's Joe DiCapua, when children are on Europe's doorstep, there can be no bigger priority.
So people are taking the most dangerous journey of their lives. We've lost 3,500 people in the Mediterranean already. People are going through transit camps that don't have anywhere near adequate facilities to keep children safe. So we think children are the most vulnerable of all the refugees and migrants we've seen across Europe this year, and far too little is being done to give them the protection that they deserve and that any parent would want for their own children.
So many times we hear reports of people trying to make it to the Greek islands and their boats sinking, and many of the victims are children. What can be done to stem that problem right at the source?
So we need a response for the kind of problems that people are fleeing from. So again, any parent would do this. If you were in Syria, where schools are being bombed, where no neighbourhood is safe. Of course you would want to flee. 4 million people have left Syria already. So we do need a political response that deals with the problem at source, and that's why it's great to see the political track of talks take up energy in recent weeks. So we do need to deal with the problem at source, but that can't excuse us from our responsibilities to deal with the children and the families that we already see in Europe and for which European governments have taken so little responsibility.
You're also concerned about the proposed detention of migrants. In fact, I spoke with the UN Refugee Agency just a few days ago, who says that some 700 migrants are locked up in Hungary.
So particularly our worry is about children being detained, which is against their rights under the Convention of the Rights of the Child. A prison is no place for a child, particularly when all they are doing is seeking a right to protection, which is the kind of Christmas gift that we should be glad to give. Children aren't coming to Europe to get our benefits or to get access to our housing. They're coming for our protection, and that's something we should be glad to give them.
So explain what you want the European countries to do regarding children in particular.
So we think there's five things that Europe needs to do. Number one is to maintain search and rescue in the Mediterranean, so to make sure there's adequate naval facilities to get children out of the water if they're at risk of drowning. We need safe and legal routes into Europe that respect the rights of children. Proper reception facilities, so children are sleeping in puddles, under wet blankets. They don't have adequate shelter or protection. Reception facilities need to be much better to deal with that. Fourthly, we need to relocate and resettle refugees fairly across the continent. But then, as we discussed, we do need to tackle the root causes and make sure that people have fewer causes to flee in the first place.
That is Kirsty McNeil. She is with Save the Children in London, and she was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The United Nations says a decision by the Central African Republic to postpone next week's elections by 3 days is not a setback for that struggling country. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric says the UN peacekeeping mission will help authorities distribute ballots and back the CAR forces and security. Voting for president and parliament were scheduled for Sunday. That's been changed now to Wednesday, December the 30th, after CAR officials decided they needed extra time to organize the voting. You can stay on top of the CAR election and the rest of the day's news at our website. We're at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
During the winter holiday season, a small town in Finland more than quadruples in population with visitors to Santa Claus Village. The picturesque little town just north of Rovaniemi is heavily dependent on tourism, with guests increasingly coming from Asia. Hong Kong visitor Gary and Guy has noticed Asians are eager to learn more about Europe.
Asia countries, they're more richer, especially for China and also Korea.
The number of Chinese traveling abroad tops 80 million a year. Sean Tipton is with the Association of British Travel Agents and says the number of holidays Europeans take has pretty much hit the saturation point.
So the really big growth market is definitely Asia, but in particular the Chinese market. Japan has always been pretty large, but China's scope, though, is absolutely immense.
China's growing middle class has made it the top spender on tourism worldwide, helping to boost tourism revenues in European cities like Rovaniemi. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition, coming to you on Christmas Day 2015. You know, about 99 million households in the United States will decorate their living rooms with Christmas trees this year. While artificial trees have grown in popularity in recent times, for many Americans, it still doesn't get more traditional than going to a tree farm to get a fresh-cut natural tree. VOA's Ariana Burianto takes us to one such farm in Great Falls, Virginia, just outside of Washington.
Visiting a Christmas tree farm in search of the perfect tree is what many American families do at Christmas time, including this young family.
We have our Christmas tree. Yeah, we're going to take it home and decorate it and put it in a stand. It's kind of a backwards concept to take a tree from outside and bring it indoors, but
yeah, putting lights on it
and ornaments
and stuff.
Lots of ornaments, and you collect the ornaments for years. I've got ones from since I was like 5 years old, and it's fun.
Abby has been coming to Crops Crops since she was seven. For her, buying a Christmas tree at this local tree farm brings back lots of childhood memories and preserves her family tradition. During Christmas season, visitors can also buy holiday decorations, such as poinsettias, wreaths, and ornaments. The farm also sells seasonal vegetables, local honey, and handicrafts all year round. Larry Kropp is the owner of this 8-hectare farm, which employs three generations of the Kropp family.
There's a lot of customers that come in, and when they come in, they say, Larry, this is our 22nd, 23rd, 24th year. We go back to 86, so it's almost 30 years coming up next year that we've been selling trees up here.
Although he has employees, Kropp relies more on his children.
Basically your own boss, even though I do work for my dad, we do what we know is what we need to get done. Being able to come up with ideas of and new ideas of things that we can do for the business and other side businesses that we can work off the land.
Like they are now?
It takes about 5 to 10 years for these trees to reach ideal height, between 1 and 4 meters. Prices vary from $48 to $400. The Fraser and Canadian firs are bestsellers. After someone finds the perfect tree, the staff will clean and bale it to make sure the needles do not damage the customer's car on their way home. For almost 30 years, Kropp Scrubs has played an important role in preserving the Christmas tradition for families around the Washington area. From Great Falls, Virginia, Ariadna Budianto, VOA News.
And now a bit more of Christmas with an eye on songs which have become new classics.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom.
Music is a big part of the holiday tradition, and singer-songwriter Jose Feliciano's Feliz Navidad is one of the most popular new Christmas classics.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad.
At a point when his career had been sagging for some time, Feliciano wrote Feliz Navidad. That was in 1970, and even today it gets tens of thousands of downloads every Christmas.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own.
Then in 1994, singer Mariah Carey and composer Walter Afanasieff wrote All I Want for Christmas Is You, and the world had a new Christmas classic. Those who celebrate Christmas, almost all of them love the traditional songs such as Silent Night and Joy to the World. But they also embrace, in a major way, the new classics, one of which came from Bob Wells and Mel Torme, who in 1945 wrote what quickly became one of the most popular holiday songs of all times, simply titled The Christmas Song, sung here by Aaron Neville.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folk dressed up like Eskimo.
Truly had a distinctive style, didn't he? Aaron Neville, what am I talking in the past tense for? The guy's still around, isn't he? Singing all over the place. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a great Friday. Now, a bit more of Aaron Neville.
Find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time, but even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.